The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timson. Great Expectations. When Dickens began Great Expectations in 1861, he thought he was writing a comic novel. "I have put a child and a good-natured, foolish man in relations that seem to me very funny," he wrote to Forster. This may have been his first idea for the relationship between Pip and the blacksmith Joe Gargery, which sits at the heart of this novel. But it soon developed into something far darker. It is a study of the class system and a man's attempt to move into a different class, and how the character one develops in youth determines how one will develop in maturity, that the great expectations we have of our future will be curtailed by our own idiosyncrasies and weaknesses. This is the position in which young Pip, the central character, is placed. Every hope he has of bettering himself and moving up the social ladder is frustrated and crushed. Like David Copperfield, it is a rites of passage novel. But Pip is no David. He is a flawed character who develops into a snob and whose values are questionable. He wants to cut himself off from his class and those who nurtured him to become a gentleman. Written in the first person, this novel goes beyond David Copperfield, for Pip's mature self is telling the story and is prepared to criticise more sharply his youthful follies than David does his. The whole book focuses on Pip's development and his gradual awareness that there is more to being a gentleman than superficially buying one's way into another class. Every character he meets adds to Pip's development. Thus, Miss Havisham, whose expectations were crushed at the altar, but still defiantly wears her wedding dress as a symbol of her betrayal, teaches Pip the power women can have over men by taunting him with the beautiful but icily cold Estella, who makes him feel inadequate and ashamed of his lowly origins. Pip never forgets Estella, later meeting her as a society beauty whom he can never touch. Dickens creates Estella as a sexually attractive young woman, not a child heroine like Little Nell, who was an innocent at the mercy of the world. Estella is a self-aware, mature character with powers of attraction she is willing to use. In creating her, was Dickens drawing on his own experiences with his mistress Ellen Ternan? It can never be determined how close their relationship was. Dickens's daughter Kate declared they had a baby, which died, but it could not have been an easy relationship with a gap of more than 20 years between them. Surely Dickens' first mature heroine, proud and independent, aware of her sexuality, owes something to the youthful and glamorous Ellen. Pip is dazzled with desire for Estella, who offers him nothing in return. In fact, Dickens does not really celebrate her sexuality. It is a portrait of a frigid woman. Another expectation crushed for Pip. An anonymous allowance enables Pip to escape his origins and begin his journey towards being a gentleman, but it is based from the start on a false premise. He believes Miss Havisham is his secret benefactor, and all his illusions are shattered when he discovers that his benefactor is the convict, Magwitch, whom he helped as a boy. He has to reassess his entire life and find values that can make sense of this extraordinary generosity. His instinctive response is revulsion, but gradually he begins to understand he has a responsibility for this man who has sacrificed all for his sake. He feels pity and helps him, and slowly an admiration for Magwitch develops, as well as a realization that he is a true gentleman created by nature. Pip's kindness to Magwitch at the end of the novel is the beginning of his redemption. Pip slowly realizes too that Joe Gargery, a plain, simple man who brought Pip up, has more of the true gentleman about him than any society stuffed shirt. Joe shows consideration for others, particularly his shrewish wife, whom he endures because he doesn't want to go wrong in the way of not doing what's right by a woman. Joe's honesty is set against the dishonesty of those tainted by society's false values. Pip comes to envy Joe, who has stayed true to his calling, whereas Pip has cut himself adrift in a world of false hopes, not great expectations. Ultimately, Dickens is saying that it is the depth of our feeling for others that marks out a true gentleman. And what should really matter to Pip is the affection of those who love him for who he is, and not what he aspires to be. Though the overall mood of this book is quite grim, which is largely due to the weighty reflections of the mature Pip, Dickens nevertheless finds many occasions for exuberant humour. With Wemmick, for instance, the lawyer's clerk, who escapes the drudgery of the office into an alternative lifestyle in his self-made castle. And Wopsle, the church clerk, who, deluded by his ambition, disastrously takes to the professional stage as Hamlet. His journey parodies Pip's. Pip and Magwitch.
"Hold your noise!"
cried a terrible voice as a man started up from among the graves at the side of the church porch.
"Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat!"
A fearful man, all in coarse grey, with a great iron on his leg, a man with no hat, and with broken shoes, and with an old rag tied round his head, a man who had been soaked in water, and smothered in mud, and lamed by stones, and cut by flints, and stung by nettles, and torn by briars, who limped, and shivered, and glared, and growled, and whose teeth chattered in his head as he seized me by the chin.
"Oh, don't cut my throat, sir," I pleaded in terror. "Pray, don't do it, sir."
"Tell us your name,"
said the man.
"Quick!"
"Pip, sir."
"Once more,"
said the man, staring at me.
"Give it mouth."
"Pip, Pip, sir."
"Show us where you live,"
said the man.
"Point at the place."
I pointed to where our village lay, on the flat inshore among the alder trees and pollards, a mile or more from the church. The man, after looking at me for a moment, turned me upside down and emptied my pockets. There was nothing in them but a piece of bread. When the church came to itself, for he was so sudden and strong that he made it go head over heels before me, and I saw the steeple under my feet, when the church came to itself, I say, I was seated on a high tombstone, trembling, while he ate the bread ravenously.
"You young dog,"
said the man, licking his lips.
"What fat cheeks you got."
I believe they were fat, though I was at that time undersized for my years and not strong.
"Darn me if I couldn't eat 'em,"
said the man, with a threatening shake of his head.
"And if I aren't half a mind to it."
I earnestly expressed my hope that he wouldn't, and held tighter to the tombstone on which he had put me, partly to keep myself upon it, partly to keep myself from crying.
"Now, looky here,"
said the man.
"Where's your mother?"
"There, sir," said I. He started, made a short run, and stopped and looked over his shoulder. "There, sir," I timidly explained. "Also, Georgiana, that's my mother."
"Oh,"
said he, coming back.
"And is that your father along o' your mother?"
"Yes, sir," said I. "Him too, late of this parish."
"Ah,"
he muttered then, considering.
"Who do you live with? Supposing you're kindly let to live, which I ain't made up my mind about."
"My sister, sir, Mrs. Joe Gargery, wife of Joe Gargery, the blacksmith, sir."
"Blacksmith, eh?"
said he, and looked down at his leg. After darkly looking at his leg and me several times, he came closer to my tombstone, took me by both arms, and tilted me back as far as he could hold me, so that his eyes looked most powerfully down into mine, and mine looked most helplessly up into his.
"Now, look here," he said. "The question being whether you're to be let live. You know what a file is?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you know what whittles is?"
"Yes, sir." After each question, he tilted me over a little more so as to give me a greater sense of helplessness and danger.
"You get me a file,"
he tilted me again.
"And you get me whittles,"
he tilted me again.
"You bring 'em both to me,"
he tilted me again,
"or I'll have your heart and liver out."
He tilted me again. I was dreadfully frightened, and so giddy that I clung to him with both hands and said,
"If you would kindly please to let me keep upright, sir, perhaps I shouldn't be sick, and perhaps I could attend more."
He gave me a most tremendous dip and roll so that the church jumped over its own weathercock. Then he held me by the arms in an upright position on the top of the stone and went on in these fearful terms.
"You bring me tomorrow morning early that foil and them whittles. You bring the lot to me at that old battery over yonder. You do it. And you never dare to say a word or dare to make a sign concerning your ever having seen such a person as me or any person some ever. And you shall be let to live. You fail, or you go from my words in any particular, no matter how small it is, and your heart and your liver shall be tore out, roasted and ate. Now, I ain't alone, as you may think I am. There's a young man hid with me, in comparison with which young man I am an angel. That young man hears the words I speak. That young man has a secret way, peculiar to himself, of getting at a boy, and at his heart, and at his liver. It is in vain for a boy to attempt to hide himself from that young man. A boy may lock his door, may be warm in bed, may tuck himself up, may draw the clothes over his head, may think himself comfortable and safe, but that young man will softly creep and creep his way to him and tear him open. I am a-keeping that young man from harming of you at the present moment with great difficulty. I find it very hard to hold that young man off of your inside. Now, what do you say?"
I said that I would get him the file, and I would get him what broken bits of food I could, and I would come to him at the battery early in the morning.
"Say, Lord, strike you dead if you don't,"
said the man. I said so, and he took me down.
"Now,"
he pursued,
"you remember what you've undertook, and you remember that young man, and you get home."
Good night, sir,"
I faltered.
Miss Havisham.
In an armchair, with an elbow resting on the table and her head leaning on that hand, sat the strangest lady I have ever seen or shall ever see. She was dressed in rich materials, satins and lace and silks, all of white. Her shoes were white, and she had a long white veil dependent from her hair, and she had bridal flowers in her hair, but her hair was white. Some bright jewels sparkled on her neck and on her hands, and some other jewels lay sparkling on the table. Dresses less splendid than the dress she wore and half-packed trunks were scattered about. She had not quite finished dressing, for she had but one shoe on, the other was on the table near her hand. Her veil was but half arranged, her watch and chain were not put on, and some lace for her bosom lay with those trinkets, and with her handkerchief and gloves, and some flowers and a prayer book, all confusedly heaped about the looking-glass. It was not in the first few moments that I saw all these things, though I saw more of them in the first moments than might be supposed. But I saw that everything within my view which ought to be white had been white long ago, and had lost its lustre, and was faded and yellow. I saw that the bride within the bridal dress had withered like the dress, and like the flowers, and had no brightness left but the brightness of her sunken eyes. I saw that the dress had been put upon the rounded figure of a young woman, and that the figure upon which it now hung loose had shrunk to skin and bone. Once I had been taken to see some ghastly